Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation with some interesting person about some interesting aspect of taste, my favorite subject, of those of you who listen know. We recently hit our 75th show mark, which is hard to believe. I think this might be 78 or 79. They go by so fast. But this next 30 minutes is going to go by even faster because I have with me today, we're very fortunate to be talking with a guest from Europe, Andrea Petrini, who is an international food journalist based in Paris, but well-eaten just about everywhere in Europe and around the world. He is the creator, the road manager, as he says, of a new band of chefs and performance artists, let's say, called Gelinas. And we're happy to have him here in the studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Thank you for joining me, Andrea.
Thanks for you, Mitchell.
So let's start with a big question, because I mean broad question, not a difficult one, because I think that in my experience, in what little experience I have bouncing back and forth between Europe and America and the chef and food circles in both places, there are some similarities and there are some differences. And I think that culturally, even though we all speak the same language of delicious food and interesting intellectual gastronomic and culinary pursuits, the food and chef worlds are two very different places here and there. Could you talk a little bit about your perception on those differences and those similarities between the U.S. and the rest of Europe, which I know is actually many places all put together?
Yeah, the easiest and also the silliest way to describe a possible difference would be to to take again the very stereotyped image of American cuisine or the American food scene, mm-hmm. as seen from Europe. One would say that the American food scene, the American restaurant scene, is more business oriented, mm. as opposed to the poor European guys who believe in their work, who build very small restaurants, who don't count numbers, who only care about the quality of their food. It's very, very stereotyped image. I would say that the Americans, they're really looking since a few years now very closely to what is happening in America, mostly I would say in New York or mm-hmm. in the big cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles. There's been a lot of talk, say 10, 15 years ago, the French in decline, the French are gone, fine dining room, fine dining cuisine is going to be obsolete. And the French didn't get it right. They said, oh, come on, we are the French.
We invented cuisine.
We invented, right. we copyrighted the cuisine. we own the copyright. And then the problem is that the first attack came first from England. Can you imagine that?
No.
I mean, going out in London was cool. The French couldn't really cope with that.
Of course not.
Then came the famous article published by the New York Times in 2001, I think, or 2002, saying kind of French is dead, Spanish cuisine is the new best mm-hmm. thing. And honestly, they couldn't get it. Really, they couldn't get it. They went awoke. They went.
The French couldn't get it.
No. And since then, there's been little by little a way of looking at what's happening in New York. How can we try to be a little bit more cool? How can we try to learn how to be a little more modern? And then the French big guys came to New York, came to the big American cities. Joël Robuchon came to New York, bringing the Atelier, which was a kind of how, say, fine dining cuisine can try to be a little more informal, tapas style. And then came all these big things. Say, David Chang, when he opened the Momo Fuku, no one knew him. Mm-hmm. But now the idea of having a fun place producing a high quality kind of cuisine, it's really hot in Europe. And also this idea of opening a small place like say Co, like say Brooklyn Fair, the place that become that can be understood for the chef like their own atelier, for only a very limited number of covers. So I think there's many links, many passerelles between Europe and the American restaurant scene.
And do you think that there is respect there between the chefs, but also the diners? Would a French person, an average person who's interested in food, believe that there are great restaurants in America or interesting things happening there? Because the perception here is that they think we eat hamburgers and hot dogs and you know, use our hands like animals.
Okay, the average French person would never believe, still doesn't believe, that there's real cuisine even in Europe.
Right.
The average French person.
Okay.
I would say the average French person is shot by a very famous short movie by David Lynch with Harry Dean Stanton, where David Lynch portrayed Harry Dean Stanton being kind of French cowboy with the baguette, with the camembert. No, the French, they still do not totally accept that there are incredible places, incredible chefs all around Europe.
Amazing.
I can imagine.
Okay.
I mean, they are still trying to digest the big boom of Ferran Adrià, right. El Bulli. Can you imagine now going to Denmark, eating herbs, white herbs, and even ants? No, for sure not. But the more well-informed perception is that definitely there are plenty of great chefs. I mean, in the well-informed circles, there's a lot of talking of, say, apart from Chang, of David Kinch in San Francisco, Daniel Patrick in San Francisco, Dan Barber here in New York, and many others, also including all the French pioneers that came here, like Daniel Beaulieu and many others.
Of course. You mentioned the impact that the New York Times article had, and it's my perception here as a journalist myself that because perhaps of our naivete or the newness to which we've come to appreciate cuisine, that food journalists hold a certain power here. People, they say something's good and we run to go see it. They say something else is good, they run to go see it. And there's part of a dynamic between the journalist and the diner, because we don't have our own food culture per se. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about where the food journalist sits in this European context. Again, I recognize that Europe is many places, but the sort of culture of newspapers and journalists and the relationship of the arts and culture to everyday life is so different there that I think maybe some comparisons can be made.
Okay, Matt. I don't know, Mitchell. Would I be totally wrong if I say that we almost do not have any more food journalism in Europe or in France? I mean, let's be clear, let's be frank. Newspapers are closing down.
Yes.
Daily magazines, sales are running very low. I honestly think that if we stick to France, there's only a couple of lucky guys that run a food page, a regular column in a national newspaper or on one of the biggest newsweeks, that they honestly run their column, they go to restaurant, they pay for their food, and they get refunded by their magazine. Mm. More and more of writers, they write little stories, like little paragraphs, little anecdotes about restaurants, more in a kind of either girlish touch, oh, that's the new place, the chef is very handsome, mm-hmm. the food is light.
Descriptive, more yes, than anything.
Yes. There's a lot of bloggers, and the bloggers, some of them are good, but they mostly spend their time bitching one to each other.
Right.
I really think that apart from a very few exceptions, say the Observer Food Monthly in England, or this new magazine run by Lotten, Per Anders Jorgensen, Full, published in Sweden, or Cooking, who is an Italian magazine run by a very nice Italian woman, Anna Morelli, a magazine where I, to which I also contribute. Mm-hmm. There's no real
journalism
professional anymore.
Journalists.
No, no, not to mention the TV shows for the average housewife under 45.
So, what does that leave the diner? The person, I mean, you and I think, spend our time in rarefied worlds where everyone is waiting for a piece of information about something interesting happening. How does anyone eat, if I may say, without? What happens when the level of professional food journalist disappears, as it's seems to be happening?
I mean, the main switch from the fine dining area, mm-hmm. Age, and what's happening today, is that people might tend to go to less expensive restaurant and go out more often, mm-hmm. especially in Paris, where mm-hmm. the flats, the apartments are so small, you cannot invite your friends for dinner, yes. so you go out. And if you go out 2-3 times a week, of course, you don't go to Joël Robuchon every night.
Right.
So die. There's this boom of so-called neo-bistro or so-called bistronomy. And most of the restaurants, they aim into that kind of category. Some of them are good value for money. Some of them are totally forgettable. Mm. And a very, very, very few of them really produce some interesting, contemporary, progressive food. I would say that in Paris, I could put a finger on less than 8 very, 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 very interesting bistronomic places.
But you have to name some now, because everyone at home has got their pen ready, writing to write.
Of course, I would say the Le Chateaubriand. Of course, I would say Saturn by Bertrand Grebeau. Of course, I would say I did a mistake. Septime by Bertrand Grebeau. Of course, I would say Saturn by half Swedish, half French chef Sven Chartier, and also Rosval, the newest one, a place that's been open since last July or August, run by a 25-ish young guy from Sardinia in the south of Italy, and a 25-ish Irish chef, previously kind of a journalist, a political journalist.
It's funny you mentioned their age, because I get the sense that the next trend in cuisine, after going to events like the MAD Symposium in Denmark, is 25-year-old cuisine. Mm-hmm. Cuisine made by 25-year-olds, which seems to be where the interesting things are happening, or at least a newfound passion is happening. People who want to work hard and are thinking hard about food. Do you agree there's a generation there that's alit with new ideas?
Yes, for sure. Being a cook is now considered very cool, very sexy. The problem, I would say, and I totally agree with David Chang, we had a couple of discussions last year, he was really looking, where is the new Marco Pierre White? Mm. Where is the total commitment? I mean, these guys, they go into the kitchen, they expect to become the new best hot thing in a couple of months, mm-hmm. they open their own restaurant. So it's a rather It's a kind of new kind of conformism. That's it's a path that everybody's following, and it might become the new conformism. Mm. I think. Can you name three or four new young chefs that do not wear tattoos?
How can you cook without a tattoo anymore? It's part on the resume. Well, everyone listening is thinking about those three chefs who don't have tattoos. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Andrea Petrini on Taste Matters.
This song is called Boy Crazy by Cookies on heritageradionetwork.org. In a mother's summer dress, oh kid, she doesn't need your help. She studied art in Spain, tall boys across her brain. Yeah, tall boys, men, they'll do anything. They sat her in the shade, threw her a parade. All lined up, marching back and forth all day.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Andrea Petrini, an international gastronomist. We are talking about post-tattoo cuisine, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
If you have any questions about it, or maybe you've thought of a great young chef who is not tattooed and you want to tell us, remember that you can write us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us your questions or your comments at TasteMattersHRN. So let's talk about this project that you've deemed yourself the road manager of, the Gelinaz. That's Gelinaz, which you can follow on Twitter. Tell us what it is and what it comes out of and where you expect it to evolve to.
Gelinaz, it's a band of chefs. It's a cook and roll band of chefs.
Cook
chefs.
And roll instead of rock and roll, you mean?
Yeah, cook
okay,
and roll.
Cook and roll.
Gelinaz started a few years ago, and it was originally composed by Fulvio Pirangelini, Massimo Bottura, Luis Andoni Adoriz. We did a couple of gigs, a couple of performances, mostly in food festivals. And then very quickly, René Redzepi, Inaki Aizpitarte, Davide Scabin joined the band. And basically, what we do not organize dinners. We do performances. Mm-hmm. The idea of Gelina is the... Nowadays, with the internet, with all these flux of communication, the simple idea of a copyright is just obsolete. So what we basically do when we do a performance, we decide about the guy, the team, and we might choose a chef. Let's mm-hmm. say Davide Scabin from the restaurant Combal.0 near Torino. Davide picked up one of his most emblematic dishes. Say veal tongue braised in Barolo red wine, and so he sent the recipe to all the other guys in the band, Fulvio Andoni, mm-hmm. René, Massimo, and everybody has to come up with an interpretation, a deconstruction, reconstruction, a total new recipe using the same ingredients. And in a certain way, it's a kind of musical technique, like in jazz music when you play a cover of an old torch song by Billie Holiday, right. Or in rock music you do a reprise, or in electronic music you do a mix. Mm-hmm. So it's cuisine using music to produce a new performance. And basically, the dinner / performance, if you come to a Gelinas dinner when we do Davide Scabin or René Redzepi, if there are 8 chefs, of 10 chefs, of 12 chefs, if we are doing the Viltong braised in Barolo, basically you are going to eat 7, 8, or 10 times the same dish. And every time is different. It's a kind of morphing. It's a kind of evolution. It's a study. It's a performance on the theme of endurance, of how a thing, a recipe, can transform itself little by little in something else. Let's say it is the equivalent in contemporary cooking of, say, going to a Bob Wilson and Philip Glass opera. Mm. Difference and repetition. Mm. Does it make sense?
It makes perfect sense. It also makes it clear how Europe and America are slightly different when it comes to the culture of gastronomy, because that sounds like a radical shift. We're still fighting here to I think, give credit to chefs as cultural artists in this way that clearly a project like this is doing. And you are bringing this to New York, are you not, this tour?
Yes, we are. We are organized first a couple of big events. The first one will be the 30th of June in Ghent, in Belgium, where and it's going to be a little different, because this time we have discovered that there was in 1820 something a chef and a food writer, a very famous Belgian food writer called Pierre-Edouard Cordelier, and he was kind of the alter Escoffier, the anti-Escoffier, because if Escoffier was codifying French cuisine for the French bourgeoisie, Cordelier was more using humbler products and studying and codifying a day-to-day kind of cuisine. Mm. So we are going to pick up the most emblematic recipe by Cordelier and the Belgian Paul Bocuse, Monsieur Roger Sauveron, which is like a big idol, a god in Belgium at least. He will come and produce and reproduce the original recipe by Cordelier in the most classic and faithful form possible. And then all the bunch of chefs, which are quite a lot, 20 chefs, will start with their own version. That means Massimo Bottura, René Redzepi, Fulvio Pierangelini, Kobe Desramult from Belgium, Virgilio Martinez from the restaurant Central in Lima, Rodolfo Guzman from Santiago in Chile, Daniel Patterson from San Francisco, Davide Scabin from Torino, Anatoly Kom from Moscow. So can you imagine a dinner with 20 chefs just proposing an ever-changing dish?
Amazing.
And then we are working on bringing Gelinas to Peru for the end of Mistura. And yes, we are planning to come to New York in the fall for a big tribute to an American pioneer, a tribute to an American, a great American chef, contemporary chef.
Wow. Let's take a step back, and I'm attending this experience. What do you want me to understand about this process as a participant, not a chef, obviously, for whom I can see an amazing legacy project, a sort of projection into a future that's tied to a past a little bit, but for the person sitting there eating 14 courses of tongue, a braised tongue, or this Cordelier dish in Belgium. What's the experience for the participant, the guest?
The experience, we hope it will not be comparable to any dining experience. You are not definitely going to a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I would say, just imagine you are going to the MoMA, and instead of going and see the beautiful work of Marina Abramović, you are going to come and see 20 something of the most cutting edge chefs in the world that have accepted to work on a very defined team, and each one producing a variation on the given team, working together, each one helping the other. The space will be different, will be a real performance. So you will see Bottura working with Chang San, and you'll see, Cristina Tosi working with Agatha Felluga from Le Chateaubriand, while Inaki Spitarte is helping Anatoly Com. And of course, it is going to be a study on taste.
Yes.
It's going to be a behavior kind of study on the theme of endurance. Mm. How many dishes can you eat, for sure? How many variation on the variation can you eat? Can your buds read? Mm. How much time, how long can you go along the process without you lose the capacity on concentration? Mm. I mean, basically, they are the same topics, the same questioning that some critics had to envision 30, almost 40 years ago, when Bob Wilson and Philip Glass produced the Letter to the Queen Victoria, or Einstein on the Beach, or even before, the Music for Changing Parts, or Steve Reich. And of course, in order also to complicate a little bit the thing, I would also like, as the road manager, to add a little bit of the unexpected, little bit like John Cage.
Right.
You see.
Right. Amazing.
Just to complicate a little bit.
Right.
No, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. Imagine that after 4 hours of dining, you just can get more, and you need a little nap, so you can go and have
and
a little nap, or you can go out and have a little walk, and then come back again.
And, I mean, in other cultural art fields, there are experiences outside music too, theater, all these sorts of their endurance. But that idea of napping and rewaking in the midst of a performance, I think, is so that the performance engulfs you is just a beautiful image and a real embodiment of the artistic quality of food that actually, as an organization, the Jane Spirit Foundation has for 30 years been asserting to people that this isn't just about dinner. That dinner is an important subject, and food is primal, but it also has this tendency to raise to another level of art.
And of course, Mitchell, if between two naps Tilda Swinton would like to join the performance, she's welcome.
Well, if Tilda Swinton is listening, and I hope she is, because I love her and all of her
movies. I do love her.
Yes,
I do.
Then maybe she'll be there. We'll look forward. So people can find out more about this by following...
When time is ripe, the news will be out.
Okay.
The information will be out.
Will be out. But you do have a Twitter for Gelinas,
yes,
don't you? At Gelinas, GELINAZ.
Yes.
I thank you so much for coming here. I feel like we've had a taste, a little bit of an entire, a new world, an opening world that I don't think people in New York or even across the country understand, that there are people thinking about food in very different ways from your day-to-day, where can we take a business client for lunch? And I think it's so important when we consider questions of taste that we acknowledge that food... really sustains us in multiple ways, our minds, our bodies, our souls. And I think that this experience, and certainly many of the other things you've been involved with, reinforce that. I think it's part of what brings this group of chefs. You just casually named many of the greatest chefs in the world coming together for something that they probably don't even fully understand either, and won't until the experience happens. And that's what I love about talking to you always, Andrea. It's really been a pleasure to have you here.
It's been a pleasure to come here.
Next week, we are going to welcome a very different type of guest with a very different subject, Urvashi Rangan, who is one of the advocacy lawyers at the Consumers Union, who produces the famous and beloved Consumer Reports, is going to be here. She's a passionate foodie, and we'll be talking about all sorts of things like labeling and arsenic and rice and all sorts of things that impact food on a very, very different level. In the meantime, maybe you should eat some braised tongue and think about all of the things you would want to do with it. You're listening to Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.